Later that evening, my uncle, who was the general contractor building our house, called me and he said, "What got into you today?" "Nothing," I responded. "Why?" He said, "Well, the guy said you came barreling into the yard with your truck, you slammed the door, took a gun and a dog over the hill out of sight. They heard one shot, you came back without the dog. Then you grabbed the goat and headed back up over the hill. Then they heard another shot. You came back, slammed the pickup door again, went back. They heard another shot, and then you came back without the goat. They said they hurried back to work before you decided they were next."
Attention, South Dakota residents. Everything is fine. Everything is beautiful. Go back to your homes. Go back to your jobs. Trust in the authority.
Work, eat, stay asleep. Work, eat, stay asleep. Work, eat, stay asleep. Work, eat, stay asleep.
Docile and distracted during times of uncertainty. This is the South Dakota Department of Propaganda Podcast.
From the Dakota Scout. Let's listen in.
The Yankton Sioux tribe in South Dakota has unanimously voted to ban Governor Kristi Noem from their reservation due to comments she made about tribes benefiting from drug cartels. This makes them the sixth of the nine South Dakota tribes to do so.
These comments were cited as offensive and reckless by Yankton Sioux tribal council member Ryan Kornoyer. The governor previously stated that Mexican drug cartels are present in the reservations, a claim supported by the state's Department of Public Safety and Attorney General's office.
This all comes after the Siston-Wahpeton Tribal Council also banned Noem earlier this week, which factored into the Yankton Sioux's decision.
For the Yankton Sioux, this move is unprecedented. It's the first time in their history they have banished someone.
South Dakota's long-term healthcare industry has been under stress, warning of imminent nursing home closures due to new federal staffing mandates. A recent analysis by the South Dakota Healthcare Association shows that over 90 state-licensed facilities are not meeting these new staff resident requirements set by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
These new regulations, finalized in April, dictate for the first time ever how many certified nurses a facility must have for each resident in its care. For some, they have up to 5 years to meet this ratio, but the industry is worried about its feasibility.
They have good reason to worry. According to the executive director of the SDHCA, Mark B. Deek, the rule requires every nursing home to provide a minimum of 3.48 total nursing staff hours per resident per day. This includes 2.45 hours from nurse aides and 0.55 hours from registered nurses. The problem: South Dakota simply doesn't have enough nurses and nurse aides.
This has resulted in 96% of South Dakota facilities not meeting that federal staffing mandate. To bring them into compliance, they'll need to find at least 299 more certified nurses who want to work in long-term and end-of-life care, which Deek says is not feasible given the ongoing nursing shortage.
Especially as it would cost an estimated $19.7 million annually to fill these positions. Add to that, since the start of the pandemic in 2020, at least 9 South Dakota communities have lost nursing homes, reducing the number of available beds.
This trend could get worse with the new staffing mandates, particularly in rural areas. The state's healthcare organizations face two options: limit admissions or downsize their facility. This leaves residents with fewer options and longer waiting times for care.
As the baby boom generation begins to put pressure on the system, it's a worrying time for the industry. So we'll be keeping an eye on developments here. Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, is going through a rough patch right now. She was once seen as a hero for keeping her state's businesses open during the pandemic, and her popularity soared. However, she's currently in hot water for some questionable decisions.
Her book titled No Going Back is causing quite a stir. In it, she defends the killing of a family dog to show her ability to make tough decisions, and there's a made-up anecdote about meeting North Korea's dictator, Kim Jong-un.
The book seems to be an attempt to impress Donald Trump, as she hopes to be his vice presidential candidate. But this has backfired with public opinion. The irony here is that Noem's attempts to become a national leader have made her a national joke.
She was on Trump's radar due to her growing popularity during the pandemic. But instead of playing it safe and looking at long-term political strategies, she dove headfirst into the vice presidential race.
This has led her down a controversial path. Her image has shifted from the tough governor standing against pandemic lockdowns to a TV pitch woman trying too hard to impress Trump.
Her book, intended to enhance her chances for a VP position, has ended up being a joke for some and a stain for others. If Noam aims to continue her political career, this book and its fallout could haunt her.
It's clear that Noam's decision to pursue this short-term opportunity hasn't done her any favors. It would have been better for her to focus on nurturing her popularity and working on the needs of South Dakotans instead.
This situation is a clear lesson in putting long-term strategy over short-term gains and not letting ambition blind you to potential pitfalls.
Rick Wyland, a former Democratic candidate for Congress in South Dakota, who has turned his attention towards ballot measures to influence public policy after three unsuccessful runs for office.
It seems that Wyland has found a unique way to push forward his policy objectives in a state where Republicans hold sway. Since 2014, ballot question committees chaired by Wyland have raised more than $3 million and led or participated in 11 measures.
Five of those were approved by voters, three are pending for this county election. Two didn't make it to the ballot, and one was rejected by voters. So it can be said that he has been quite influential.
Wyland's strategy is based on his belief that some progressive policies can win over voters when they're presented directly to them, bypassing the usual partisan politics.
Among the proposals that have won voter approval are those relating to higher minimum wage, stricter anti-corruption laws, and expanded Medicaid eligibility. This year, statewide ballots are expected to include measures that would restore abortion rights and repeal the state sales tax on groceries.
Besides this, the article also talks about Wyland's political journey. He started off as a staffer for then-Congressman Tom Daschle and rose through the ranks to become a national finance director and senior advisor. He also served under President Bill Clinton as a regional director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Despite losing several elections, he continued to work for policy changes through ballot initiatives. He co-founded TechHikeBack.org with Dre Samuelson, a former Daschle staffer and former chief of staff for Senator Johnson. The group organizes ballot measures and ballot question committees.
The article states that Wyland's efforts have not been without controversy. Critics have accused him of exploiting the ballot measure process and questioned the sources of his funding. However, Wyland argues that he's simply doing what elected officials should be doing, listening to the people they represent.
The article also highlighted how Wyland's team introduced two ballot measures in response to South Dakota's major scandals in 2013, EB-5 visa scandal and Gear Up Education scandal. One for nonpartisan primary elections was rejected, but the other measure aimed at reducing corruption and increasing government transparency was passed, but later mostly repealed by the Republican-controlled legislature.
Despite some setbacks, Wyland's efforts have resulted in impactful changes like capping the interest rate of payday loans at 36% in 2016. And he is hopeful for his upcoming measures, removing the state sales tax on groceries and restoring abortion rights, which are pending verification of signatures.
The article concludes with Wyland's assertive stance on his approach to policy change through ballot measures. He maintains that these ballot measures facilitate direct democracy, which allows voters to directly shape laws and policies.
This certainly provides food for thought on how issues-based campaigning can transcend party politics and make an impact at the grassroots level.
It goes to show how individuals can influence public policy in meaningful ways, even outside the traditional political arenas.
Oh, fuck these prices today. Oh, fuck these prices. I'm not paying for that.
Lemons or mangoes, taxis or tax.
You can shove these prices right up your ass.
A night out with the lady, eggs in a row.
You can shove these prices right up your hole.
Oh, fuck these prices today.
Oh, fuck these prices.
I'm not paying for that.
Chicken or bacon, lackey or gas.
You can shove these prices right up your ass.
Dishwasher tablets, it's all such a farce.
You can shove that price tag straight up your arse.
The acting chief of the Ogallala Sioux Tribe Department of Public Safety, John Pettigrew, recently testified before the U.S. House of Representatives, stating that the department is funded at just 15% of its needs. This funding shortfall has resulted in a force that is less than half strength and long wait times for services.
The Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, where the Ogallala Sioux tribe is based, is larger in area than Delaware. Yet this shortage means tribal members can wait up to an hour for non-emergency service. Even emergency calls can take just as long if officers are tied up elsewhere on the reservation.
Pettigrew wasn't the only one raising these concerns. In 2 days of hearings, six South Dakota-based tribal leaders spoke about the massive gap between federal funding and needs in law enforcement and education.
Shockingly, education funding for Native American children is less than one-third the rate for children of active duty military families. Native American tribal nations in South Dakota mainly rely on federal funding for basic public services per treaty provisions dating back to the 1800s.
Pettigrew also highlighted the strain on his officers, who he said are overworked, underpaid, and on the verge of burnout. He also points out that his officers are paid less than their counterparts in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, FBI, and state-level agencies.
Cher Wright Plank, vice chair of the Tribal Council for the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, also stated that their tribal police force is half the size it was in 2000, despite having twice the population and three times the violent crime.
Another concern is education. Cecilia Fire Thunder, president of the Oglala Lakota Nation Education Coalition, compared federal and state funding for schools. She revealed that per student funding for Native American students is less than half of what state schools receive.
Troy Linderman from Rosebud Street Francis Indian School also highlighted how career and technical education programs have shown promise in Indian country. But even those programs only receive a paltry $16 million nationwide from federal Perkins program.
Clearly, there's a massive disparity here, with far-reaching consequences for these communities. Both law enforcement and education need a significant increase in funding to meet the needs of Native American tribes.
A group named South Dakotans for Better Marijuana Laws is pushing to get recreational marijuana legalization on South Dakota's 2024 ballot, having just submitted over 29,000 signatures to the state's Secretary of State office.
This same group helped put the issue on the ballots in 2020 and 2022 as well. In 2020, the pro-legalization amendment passed with 54% of the votes, but was later overturned. A similar effort in 2022 was rejected with 53% voting against it.
The worries now are about possible voter fatigue, since this would be the third time the issue is put up for a vote. Currently, recreational pot is legal in 24 states. Supporters argue the economic benefits, like the nearly $3 billion in tax revenue states collected in 2022.
Opponents, however, point to potential social costs and health risks from marijuana use. Other issues likely to appear on the fall ballot include abortion, open primaries, a grocery tax repeal, work requirements for Medicaid, and removal of mail-only references in state documents. Critics have long warned that the Russians have infiltrated parts of the Republican Party, with GOP members echoing Russian talking points and engaging in disinformation campaigns.
Now this criticism has extended to include not just former Republican representatives, but current ones as well. For example, two powerful Republican chairs of the House Intelligence Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee openly warned about Russian propaganda seeping into their party in speeches made on the House floor.
The article also highlighted the use of three types of compromise, disinformation, extortion, and bribery, that are supposedly being employed by the Russians. There are talks of Russian propaganda being peddled online, false information originating from Russia being spread within right-wing circles, and even false narratives making way into the speeches of some Congress members.
One such example provided in the article is Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has uplifted a false narrative claiming that Ukraine is waging war against Christianity while Russia is protecting it. Another example includes Senator J.D. Vance spreading misinformation about Ukraine.
Then there's the issue of Russian disinformation via our own intelligence services. For instance, an informant named Alexander Smirnov spread false claims about the Bidens taking bribes from Burisma, which were then exploited by opponents for political gain.
The article also brings up the notion that some U.S. politicians might be extorted and blackmailed into supporting Russia's agenda. While there isn't much evidence to back this up, some Republicans have voiced this theory.
This leads us to another type of compromise, bribery. The article discusses how European politicians were reportedly paid by Russians to interfere in EU elections and questions whether similar actions could be taking place in US politics.
The Trump family's financial ties to Russia were also brought up in this context, with 63 individuals with Russian passports or addresses having invested nearly $100 million in Trump properties as of 2017.
Although we have to remember that these remain allegations until proven otherwise. But the article does highlight that this potential flow of money from Russia to U.S. politicians is cause for concern and warrants further investigation.
Importantly, it wraps up by underlining that Russian goals of undermining our elections and sowing division are slowly being recognized within the GOP itself, leading to a rising rejection of such tactics.
U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland has proposed a change in marijuana policy at the federal level, suggesting a downgrade in its legal status. However, this doesn't signify federal endorsement of its recreational or medicinal use, despite many states legalizing it.
Essentially, moving marijuana from being seen as one of the most dangerous and least useful substances to a less serious category signals the Biden administration's intent to ease restrictions on this drug. But there are still major issues to tackle due to the split between state and federal law.
For years, the federal government has overlooked state legal marijuana operations. This move seems to bolster that stance, but it's still unclear what the implications of this reclassification will be. The Justice Department has not made Garland's proposal public, and there is an expectation of changes during months of rulemaking.
Important note here, even in states where marijuana is legal for recreational use, it would likely still be deemed illegal under federal law, unless it meets stringent regulations similar to other Schedule III drugs like Tylenol with codeine or anabolic steroids.
Precisely, and many state legal medicinal marijuana dispensaries do not meet these criteria. Hence, according to Sean Hauser from Denver-based marijuana law firm, The Scent LLP, cannabis and state legal dispensaries will remain in violation of federal law.
The difference between Schedule I and Schedule III is significant. While Schedule I drugs are seen as ripe for abuse and possessing no medicinal value, Schedule III drugs are acknowledged to have some medicinal value.
Rescheduling might mean states are unable to make any significant preparations until more details are released. However, some states are considering potential impacts like ease restrictions on cannabis research and potential tax deductions for legalized businesses.
Rescheduling alone may not directly address several complaints from members of the marijuana industry and advocates about taxes, banking, and criminal justice, but it could spur momentum toward other changes.
While rescheduling doesn't automatically fix these issues, advocates are hopeful it will push towards full legalization. A bill was reintroduced last week by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Democratic Sens, Cory Booker, and Ron Wyden to deschedule the drug entirely.
It's important to note, though, that any progress could potentially be reversed by a change in administration, although there's currently no indication of this happening.
So while we're starting to see some movement on this issue at the federal level, there's still a long way to go and a lot of unknowns remain. South Dakota is at a crossroads. It can continue to be isolated or join the growing passenger rail network. This is the first time in over 50 years that South Dakota has had an opportunity to change its status as flyover country and provide more affordable and convenient transportation options to its residents.
The Federal Railroad Administration conducted workshops in February 2023, where they identified how to better connect underserved parts of the country with passenger rail networks. A new train route was proposed that would connect Rapid City, Pierre, Sioux Falls, along with points in between with Denver and the Twin Cities.
However, after a South Dakota State Railroad Board meeting in 2024, misconceptions arose that could halt this progress. Some people believe there's no travel demand here, while others argue that disinvestment in the railroad infrastructure should prevent us from ever having passenger rail service.
But these beliefs aren't accurate. The FRA study concluded that there is significant travel demand for trains in South Dakota. We have two major population centers and a thriving tourist industry. Plus, being a less densely populated state, people often have to travel longer distances to reach essential services.
The proposed rail route from Twin Cities to Denver has over four times the travel demand than other routes. The benefits to the states served by this route are estimated at $271 million, which far exceeds the cost to operate the train.
Indeed, the article also argues that while current railroad infrastructure may not support passenger trains, it doesn't mean we don't need rail service. Billions are already being spent on subsidizing highways and aviation networks. The funds to get South Dakota on the map can certainly be found.
Let's not forget about the argument concerning geological challenges related to Pierre Shale. The article suggests utilizing a different alignment that has fewer recorded soil issues. And really, these engineering challenges can be overcome with a little creativity.
As for concerns about losing special transportation circumstance grant funding if passenger rail is established, that's likely to happen anyway as Minnesota or Iowa establishes passenger rail service that enters South Dakota.
To wrap up, this proposed rail network would serve large and small communities, advance economic and social well-being in rural areas, provide enhanced connectivity for the national long-distance passenger rail system, and reflect public engagement and local and regional support.
You know what? Fuck it. I hate puppies. I can't stand fucking puppies or brown people. Don't like it? Eat my ass like groceries, you prick. Trump does this kind of fucked up shit and you can't suck him off hard enough. I have one mistake and you throw me to the wolves. Fuck all of you. I quit.